This is Dr. Mike and Dr. Charlie. We're here to talk about the origins of quantitative medicine. Charlie's going to ask me some questions, and I'm going to do my best to answer them in a reasonable length of time.
Okay.
Let's go.
You started this quantitative medicine 20 years ago. What was that all about? What was the matter with medicine as it was? What motivated you?
Outside of true acute illnesses like infections, strep throat, that sort of thing, I felt medicine simply had no way to cure most of the diseases that we were seeing.
What sort of diseases you mean?
Diabetes, coronary artery disease, strokes, heart attacks, amputations in diabetics, blindness in diabetics, high blood pressure. The list is long, and there was just simply no effective therapy for any of these diseases. There were just little nibbles at the edges of these diseases. There was no true cure.
Wait, there's all sorts of things for this, isn't there? There's heart bypasses, and there's statins, and there's...
Perfect example. In the acute setting, that's back where I said their medicine was effective. Man, if you're having a heart attack, your arteries are so clogged, you're not getting enough blood to your heart, a bypass is a wonderful thing. It's just short of miraculous. You just restore the blood flow to a heart, you now have a functioning heart that's got what it needs. That's very different than, oh, gee, you might have a heart attack someday, and you might have some blockage someday, and heck, you should take this drug because it might help prevent that. That first is neat. It's wonderful. It's effective. It's late in the disease process, which is another thing I don't like about it, but it works. The statins functionally don't work.
Okay, well, I mean, so this is sort of, you're going to prevent these diseases somehow? That's what quantitative medicine does?
Quantitative medicine discovers the early roots of disease, which are knowable and measurable, and formulates a very specific to each individual pathway to correct or reverse the diseases.
Is this some special branch of medicine? I mean, is there a...
Should be. In my opinion, there ought to be a residence that you go to instead of internal medicine where you learn to use all the drugs that are ineffective, or family practice where you get to console parents about their kids' viral illnesses. There ought to be a quantified, reproducible, teachable model of how to help all patients become healthy and stay healthy. We do not have a residency in that, and it is a known way to do that. I've got that in quite a great deal of detail.
Okay, but you're doing it. So,
yes.
So you start this 20 years ago, so you would have people come to you and you'd say, well, okay, I think this person's probably going to get heart disease, and you're going to do something with them that's going to prevent that? I mean, how did you started with this? Nobody was coming to you saying, practice an unknown medical field on me.
Well, to some extent, that's exactly what happened. Where I live, a lot of my patients were engineers, and they'd bring in their spreadsheets, which showed their blood pressure when they woke up in the morning and their blood pressure when they went to bed the night. I had one guy, he even had his a spreadsheet showing me what it was when he was tired and when he was happy, and one even showed me some blood pressure during sexual activity. These great engineers brought all this data to me showing they were measuring the things that doctors purported to care about. And they all recounted to me they had taken them to their doc, and no doc cared or wanted to see that data. And man, I was hungry for that data because it meant it was measurable and therefore modifiable, because you can't modify what you can't measure. And that's what one of the things that really got me going.
Okay. I know I hear a lot about people, you know, I used to say cancer will get your heart disease. Well, I mean, do most people die of these diseases you can prevent or not? Or what's the deal?
Well, memento mori, remember death. What I'm not proposing is some form of immortality. What I'm proposing is prolonging a healthy, active life and eventually dying, obviously. There's no exemption to that. But if you correct these degenerative diseases, and they're degenerative, then you restore vitality, energy, intellect, pleasure, joy in the moment to a life for many, many more decades than would otherwise be the case.
So cancer is a degenerative disease?
Absolutely.
And heart disease?
Absolutely.
What else is?
Well, the other diseases associated with it, which are high blood pressure and what people refer to as high cholesterol, by the way, there's a funny story. all of these are degenerative. In other words, when you measure them in youth, they're fine, and as we age, they become less fine, eventually become bad. And this declination, this decrease in all of these markers, by the way, you've got to measure it to know this, are associated with the emergence of these end stages events like kidney failure and stroke and heart attack and cancer. So you can alter those pre-existing tendencies in a way that it changes the glide path of that decline. So instead of the plane crashing at 50, 60, or 70, it's a nicer, slower, and not necessarily rapid, matter of fact, not rapid, decline into a nice gentle age of 80, 90 being perfectly reasonable numbers for most people, even though most people don't live that long.
Is there any people that don't get these things, or is this inevitable? I mean, but yet you have a way to stop it. There must be people that...
Well, it's within our genetic capacity to not have these diseases. It's not a bizarre exception that someone lives to be 100, 120. It's why don't the rest of us live to 100, 120? And what we know is, for example, there are examples even in the modern world of hunter-gatherers who have a more primitive lifestyle, and they don't suffer these degenerative diseases. They're not genetically distinct. They have the same underlying fundamental genetics that we all do. They're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% Neanderthal. They're all, in other words, they're Homo sapiens who evolved out of the last great ice age. We all did. We share the genetics. Why don't they get those diseases? They don't have a degenerative lifestyle or a disease.
Well, which civilizations are degenerative lifestiles? I don't want to go be a hunter-gatherer. I don't think I'd do that well.
You don't need to be, but you can take the wisdom that is virtually built into our genetic code and optimize that. Instead of paying attention to getting up in the middle of the night and checking your email, you can say, oh, sleep's very important. In our hunter-gatherer past, we must have slept a lot. Sure, we didn't have light bulbs, so let's sleep better. We can tease out all of these variables that affect longevity and incorporate them in our modern life. And certainly one of the important things was the nutrient quality of food. If you look at the nutrient quality of the food over the last 50 years, the nutrient quality of food in the United States and in most of the industrial world is just horrible. It's just a chemistry experiment based on not enough information about the nutrient needs of the human body, or the exercise needs of the human body, the sleep needs of the human body, or the spiritual needs of the human body.
Wait, you're saying hunter-gatherers eat better than I do?
Absolutely.
Well, they're out eating bugs and rats. And
yum!
Whatever they can catch. I mean, surely the stuff I get at the grocery store is better, no?
No, and for nefarious reasons. They're both are exploitative reasons. It's cheaper to sell you a box of cereal than to sell you and get you to prepare and cook some nice broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage and so on and so forth, or have a nice fresh, really yellow egg from a free-range chicken in an organic environment who's living on a mixed diet. That egg is nutrient nuclear bomb, and it's full of so many rich lutein and lycopene and B12 and many a whole array of the yellow-orange nutrients that we need, which is an example. So that egg is not a chemical experience. It's an evolutionary jewel that's come to us through millions of years of co-evolutionary biology. We're made for that. It's made for us. That's true of bugs, by the way. They've got great proteins. They have chitin, which is good for cholesterol. They've got all kinds of things.
And hardly weight. What about red meat and saturated fat and all this stuff we've been told not to eat?
We can in detail go through how we were misled into believing these things were bad for us. It wasn't always malicious intent, but it was mixed up with inappropriate commercial interest and inappropriate governmental desire to control and affect behavior. There's lots of kind of interesting plots to the story, but the fact is they're never... Hear that. This is really bizarre until you unpack it. There has never been meaningful data linking saturated fats to heart disease or any bad outcomes. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that links saturated fats to great health. So that's just not true. I'm not going to spend the time in this little discussion to go through that, but there's no evidence that saturated fats are bad for us.
What about red meat causing cancer?
Same is true with cancer, one of the most commonly cited, and I'm going to use some of these silly examples that are in the book, one of the most commonly cited sources for this is the China study. Now, the China study is a derivation of a larger study that was looking at 69 provinces in China and the incidence of diseases associated with certain food types. They looked at wheat, they looked at rice, they looked at light green vegetables, dark green vegetables, meat consumption, dairy. And it turns out in China, in these 69 provinces, the more meat you ate, the longer you lived. The odd thing, and I'll leave it at the word odd, is that the book written called The China Study, which had the same raw data to draw from, drew the exactly opposite conclusion. They did that by virtue of kind of picking and choosing what data they were going to look at. But if you look at the raw mortality data, the more meat you ate, the longer you lived. It was that simple. So here again, there's a lot of prejudice against meat. It's usually bound up in political or moral issues, and that's worth attending to. But if you're saying, I want to live long and well, eat some red meat, especially starting at 65, because protein over in an older population really does increase longevity.
Okay, so food is a problem, but I guess the hunter-gatherers are out hunting and gathering, so where that gets us into exercise.
That's right.
Is that also that necessary?
That's right. The system, the body always makes sense. This is one of the little rubrics that I use. And the body makes sense in this way. Since our evolutionary past required vigor and strength and endurance and cunning and coordination and balance and reflexes, we wouldn't be here if not all of those things were available as an organism. We were designed for that end, and I'm not trying to get into a design versus an evolutionary. I'm just understanding the word design as an engineer would think about a problem. We are designed to be vigorous, strong, fast, coordinated, cunning, etc. That's built into us. And like, as the body makes sense, if the body is no longer required to do these things, it quits creating the capacity to do those things. It's conserving energy, conserving nutrients, conserving proteins, etc.
Wouldn't we want to conserve?
Of course
things,
we would.
I mean,
if we were in a time of lack of food or there was no hunting available and nothing to gather, yes, that's not our life. Since we have excess, not inadequate amounts of nutrition, so what we wind up doing is overeating and under-exercising for the biology with which we are endowed. So we go out and reproduce that vigor, and sure enough, we become that young, vigorous hunter-gatherer.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, aren't you?
You can still go get your hair and nails done. Don't get me wrong.
But aren't you just saying that eat right and exercise, that's the solution here? I mean,
bingo. This is one of the most misleading phrases I've ever run into. Every time I've seen the phrase eat right and exercise, it's been written on the lab sheet the doctor gave my patient who was sick. It's that you have to unpack eat right and exercise. If eat right and exercise is the old food pyramid, let me put it this way, the old American Diabetic Association dietary guidelines were the only way I knew you could cause diabetes. In other words, it didn't help, it made things worse. So if
it
caused diabetes. It's a very carbohydrate intensive diet. So if you actually eat right, and that's a complex thing, it's not a simple phrase, and exercise right, and that's a complex, not a simple phrase referring to a very specific kind of exercise, yes, eat right and exercise will work. The way it's typically understood based on general guidelines, it's misleading to the point of causing disease.
Okay, so you say the diet and the exercise, they have to be specifically right. You mean each person's different, or you need to, how do you tell, let me back up a little bit. So you say that the cure is you got to be the right diet, the right exercise. How do you know what that is?
Well, there's a kind of a conceptual version of the answer, and there's a precise version. The conceptual version is, since as hunter-gatherers, as our genetic ancestors, we hunted in tribes and clans, different people had different functions within the tribes and clans. There were night watchmen, there were day watchmen, there were the aggressive big hunters, there were the long-term gatherers. In other words, there's a diversity of biological function. And if you don't recognize that going in, you're going to think everybody has to eat the same thing and exercise the same way and, you know, sleep the same amount and the same. But the fact is, there is some variety in the biology of the human capacity and optimal design. So you need to measure these things. You need to measure the variables that reflect the particular individual's ideal activity.
What do you measure? How much I can lift, or
Well, actually, one of the more important measurements is what's called VO2. That means volume of oxygen. That means what's your biological power? What's the capacity of your cells to repair themselves, to carry on immune functions, to reverse coronary artery disease? So biological power measured through VO2 is one of the functions you want to know. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's got to have a VO2 of 70 milligrams per milliliter of oxygen, but you need to be whatever your optimal is. So if you're 35, you make it 45, you'll be a lot healthier. You won't necessarily be 75 or 85 or 90 like Lance Armstrong, for example. But we measure the things that matter. VO2 is an example of that. Testosterone is an example of that. Insulin is an example of that. Growth hormone is an example of that.
These are blood tests?
These are blood tests.
But VO2 is not a blood
test. No, it's a physiological test. That's right.
Oh.
And they're all of them. You want to know a broad array from multiple directions of what is your biological age. How old are you as a biological being? How near that optimal, strong, vigorous hunter-gatherer is your biology? Restore it to that optimization, and you can.
So how do I restore it?
Well, you have to first measure it. You can't know how to get to Kansas City if you live in San Jose if you don't know you're in San Jose. You've got to start with a known place. And then from that known place, you can properly plot where you want to go. Now, for example, if you're one of those in that clan, in that possible gene pool who are insulin resistant, you may have normal glucose, but you may have higher than normal insulin. So that's the guy who's going to go on and get diabetes and likely to go on to get cancer, because insulin is cancerogenic, if I can invent that word. So then you're going to go and adjust your behavior so that you no longer have a high insulin. Now, notice I didn't say glucose. People hear the word insulin, they turn it into glucose. But in this guy's case, we're going to try to lower his insulin. Let's suppose we've got a guy who has a very high cortisol level. He's stressed out. He doesn't get enough sleep. He's worried about too many things. Well, cortisol is going to affect all kinds of diseases, including dementia and cancer. And guess what? He has a lot of intentional control over his cortisol levels. So he'll have to go and specifically attend to relaxation techniques, to good sleep hygiene, to probably a spiritual discipline like meditation, contemplation. Those are the ways that he's going to address that particular weakness in his system.
Okay. So do I just have to do this once and I'm all set? Or?
Well, we're all here to fight entropy. In other words, everything falls apart, left alone. And so these numbers are going to have to be, one, find what's wrong and address it and fix it, measure it again, address it and fix it. Humans are opaque to themselves. We all think we're living well and perfectly, and we're eating right and exercising, and we usually aren't. We're drifting from one unknown biological ideal. So you have to measure things, again, as a sort of biological mirror. How am I doing? Maybe I have started to slip on the number of drinks of wine or desserts in my week and that sort of thing. So you have to iteratively test, measure, and modify, because we all get worse over time without careful attention, and that's what the measurement and the modify is so important for.
Okay. And will this work for everybody? Anybody can do this, or is there some people that can't do it? What percentage of people it work for?
I have some people who started in 85 and did very well. In my cohort of nearly 2,000 people, they all got better.
So.
Period.
Some got
more better than others. Let's be honest.
Yeah. But I mean, did it prevent for a lot of these things, or maybe they haven't. 20 years in a lifetime.
No, it's not.
Yeah. So this is the point of quantitative medicine then. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
So let's see. So to summarize, it's that we actually don't have to get all these diseases, and the likelihood of us getting them can be measured early on, and at that point it's possible to divert it and avoid it.
That's right.
But you got to keep at it, keep plugging away at it. That's the point. Okay, that's quantitative medicine.
The secret to the whole story, the secret sauce, some people call it, is you. It's your choice. It's your will. You have to will this end. I want to be better. I want to live longer. I want to feel better. I want to be a better husband, wife, father, grandfather, and I want to enjoy the life that I have. And that's not always out of selfish needs. It's also out of desire to help and serve others. But you can be a more robust biological being by doing these things. And it's available to anybody. But the secret sauce is you. It's an act of the will. You have to choose these things. But you cannot choose wisely by just following generic advice. You have to have specific advice defined or devised or derived from your own biology. It works.